Attention listeners, we're excited to announce that AfterSight will be moving to our new office on March 26th. As we make this transition, our services will be down most of the day. We apologize for any inconvenience, but truly appreciate your understanding as we start this new chapter. Thank you for listening to AfterSight.
You're listening to an AINC original podcast. We believe you don't have to do life without a compass. Let us be your guide on this amazing journey. Welcome to Navigating Life with Vision Loss.
Welcome everyone to NLVL. We are in August, so thank you for tuning in again as we're talking about getting ready to go back to school. Or back to university, to college in this case, this week. So the last week we talked a little bit more about grade school, junior high school age, and getting ready and advocating for students at that age level. But today we're starting a two-part series, and our guest this week will be Melissa Cermak, and she is with the Access Center at Metropolitan State University, Denver. And so we'll be talking a little bit about if you're entering college this year and needing accommodations and how to go about doing those things and getting what you need with her. So, Melissa, thanks so much for joining us this week.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. I was excited to be a part of this.
Well, Melissa, can you tell us a little bit about your role at the Access Center and just maybe a little bit about your background?
Sure. So my name's Melissa. I am the Associate Director at the Access Center at Metropolitan State University of Denver, and I've been here for over 15 years, so kind of longstanding fixture on campus now. My background started actually in school psychology and then mixed in a little counseling psychology. So I worked as a school psychologist in Iowa as I was finishing up my graduate work at Iowa State. Then transitioned and did an internship in counseling psychology. So as a staff psychologist at the University of Buffalo's Counseling Center. And then when my husband and I moved back to Colorado, I worked at the Learning Effectiveness Program at the University of Denver, working with students with learning disabilities. So it's a fee-for-service program there. And then came to MSU Denver and have worked at the Access Center working with the student population I work with has been a really good fit with my background in working with students with all forms of disabilities. So both learning disabilities, ADHD, autism, to mental health, which I think has been a growing population that we serve. So having that background working in a counseling center has been also really helpful. And just in terms of my time at MSU Denver working with our students who are blind or have low vision, that's become kind of my population that I'm also working specifically with in our office.
Great. Well, thanks for giving us that overview. What services does the Access Center provide for students, I guess, generally with disabilities, and then, you know, specifically for the students you're working with who are blind or have low vision?
Sure. So, yeah, the Access Center is a support office on campus for students with disabilities. We work with over 1,300 students at MSU Denver who have some form of a disability. And our role is really to make sure that students have full access in their learning environments, that we kind of are leveling the playing field for students who might experience barriers as a result of a disability. And so to do that, we provide academic accommodations to create access. And then we also do quite a bit with technology, helping students to connect to various technologies to just increase their access. And I also think like efficiency with academic tasks, right? There's a lot of tools out there that a lot of students can benefit from that can assist them in terms of just being able to get through their schoolwork more efficiently and those kinds of pieces. So that's kind of generally what we do. I think when I'm working with my students who are blind or have low vision, there's a greater focus on the accessibility of the course materials in those cases. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of what is taught in the classroom kind of sometimes depends on that visual frame of reference. And so we're doing a lot more to make sure that the materials are converted to accessible formats. That could include electronic formats. So the student population I work with on my caseload, our students generally using screen readers. Our technologist on staff also provides Braille for some students. And while generally electronic formats and Word docs of textbooks work well, there's always some component if a student can use tactile materials that sometimes tactiles are helpful in those cases. Right. And then there's sometimes really critical images in courses. And sometimes the best way to get at that is, you know, text-based descriptions if we can't do a tactile representation of that. So that's kind of the, you know, nuanced area, I think, when we're talking about kind of vision needs.
Do you have, if you're doing Braille, are you able to do the kind of dimensional printing of images, if that is helpful?
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't personally do that. I consider myself, in terms of as the accessibility coordinator for our students, particularly our students who are blind or low vision, I'm kind of the point of connection to see the whole picture, figure out what accommodations are needed, and then I work very closely with our assistant director, Ione Priest, who does all the magic in the conversion of content and all of the technology pieces. We do use a model where we do everything in-house. So we don't, so we do have a brailler, we have a thermal embosser that creates tactile images and content. So I think we do a good job in that respect of being able to do a lot for our students in-house. But it definitely, you know, takes time. And so I know that'll be part of our discussion of kind of what can folks do. But yes, we are doing all that conversion in-house.
And do you ever find accommodations are needed? Just as you were talking, I started thinking about things like science labs and things like that, that may be tactile, you know, in and of themselves, but just accommodations so students would know where, you know, different things are at, and maybe dealing with some things you don't want to, you know, accidentally tip over or something like that.
Yes. I mean, it's been interesting in my years at MSU Denver. One of the reasons I really started to specifically work with this population is our students used to come in and just meet with any coordinator. And then everyone was trying to kind of support students. And what we were finding is we started to have students who were taking like general bio, and it was like, oh, well, this is just a one-off, right? One student who's blind taking general bio will make it work. And then it was two. And then all of a sudden we had, you know, four semesters in a row of anatomy and physiology, and we're realizing this isn't just a passing fancy or just a kind of side note. This is becoming a part of our process. And that needed a lot more coordination than we were giving it to be really thoughtful, I think, and intentional in the work we were doing. So from that is where we created this, what we call a proactive collaborative model, which really meant kind of engaging earlier with our faculty and our students to figure out what is the course about? What are the learning objectives? What's going to be used in the course, and how can we make sure that the student has the most access possible in those cases? And so, yes, sometimes for labs, we have had to hire lab assistants for our students, not only from a safety standpoint, but just, you know, again, navigating some of the materials in the lab and those pieces. We're very fortunate. There's a faculty member in the chemistry department, April Hill, who has some experience teaching chemistry to students who are blind. And so, you know, she's also kind of a great resource on campus as well. But yeah, it's often kind of looking at the learning objectives, looking how the material is going to be presented, what are going to be the activities students are going to be asked to do, looking at the students' kind of skills, because I think that comes in, or are they good with tactile and information? Are they, what skills and proficiencies do they have with the tools they use, and fitting all the pieces together, and trying to do that well before a semester starts, so that in the midst of semester, it's just little tiny minor fires that pop up, because there's always something always that something, we didn't anticipate, rather than full blown, blazes that can throw a student off course. So,
and that kind of leads us into the talking about the transitioning between high school and college. And so you've had a student and parents who've been used to getting, having the needed accommodations and advocating. But now this is a whole new system. It may not be as local, to them as their high school was. What are common challenges that you see with students when they're transitioning, that high school into college?
I think we have to appreciate there are definitely different legal systems that we fall under. So with, the K-12 setting, you have the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA. And so that is a success-based model, right? And you're providing a lot of support and specialized instruction. Post-secondary, so colleges and universities, mm-hmm. fall under the Americans with Disabilities Act and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. And the focus is on access. So it is, again, to make sure that individuals have access, but we don't have that component that is like specialized instruction, right? So mm-hmm. we're going to assume a student is meets the skills and can be successful in college. They've gotten into college and they're going to be treated like every other student when it comes to the instructional model for the most part. So I think the biggest areas of transition there are related to self-advocacy and being able to advocate for themselves, mm-hmm. being able to communicate what their needs are in a really timely fashion. Being able to navigate lots of different systems. I think in the K-12 setting, the textbooks are kind of set, and there's a few places for teachers to make it their own, but there is a curriculum they're working with. And the university setting, a faculty member often has a lot more choice in the materials they're using, particularly those supplemental materials. Mm-hmm. And that's where some of the challenges come in, right? As if everyone uses this textbook in, senior, US Gov,
right,
it can look at a multitude of different forms of text that are going to support a government class in college.
So different things, just like you said, it's just a different system. So keeping that mm-hmm. in mind, that's a little bit different mindset.
I think one big transition area we see with students as well is particularly those who have received services through, say, an individualized education plan and have received mm-hmm. special education services is the student is kind of a passive, can be in a passive role in those situations, right? They have a test and they're going to use their accommodations, and their case manager or their special ed teacher is going to step in and is like, oh, well, we're going to take you here and we're going to do the test. And at the college level, you're going to have a test in the class. It's going to be your responsibility to make sure you have accommodations in place before your classes start, and you have to schedule those exams. And so there's a lot that falls more responsibility on the part of the student to manage those things.
Right. And as a student is entering and they're making that transition and needing to do that for themselves, is the best thing for them to do to contact the Access Center in the case of MSU Denver or the equivalent, wherever they are? Mm-hmm. And when should they be doing that?
Yeah. I think the earlier, the better, mm-hmm. right? And so we try, particularly we're rapidly approaching the start of the fall semester. I think it starts maybe August 19th. Mm-hmm. But we've been around all summer, and that's when our students are doing their new student orientations. And so I do think particularly students who are blind, low vision, would be using kind of alternative accessible formats of materials or need that. The earlier, the better. So we always say summertime is a great time if you're going to start in the fall to get connected with our office. We do a first appointment called an accommodations eligibility appointment, where we talk through with the student, kind of getting a sense of what are the accommodations they've used, what's the technology they've used in the past, where have they experienced barriers, what are their strengths, because that's as important as well, knowing what really works for a student. And we get a whole complete picture. So we're also asking about health and wellness. We're asking about social supports. Are they working? Are they commuting to campus? Right? All of those mm-hmm. pieces to determine kind of what their needs are. And so to do that in the summer is wonderful. I would say sometimes even with our students who are blind, low vision, our faculty sometimes disappear in the summer as well, and we want to have these conversations. So with our continuing students, we're having conversations in April as they're finishing up their spring semesters or getting into the end of the spring semester to start our planning for classes that are going to start in August, so that we can maximize all that time over the summer to work on the content. In January, for January starting classes, we're hoping to meet with them in November. So we're trying to do as much as we can early on so that we can, like I said, be in a place where we can really fully support their access. Right. Do we have students that we learn about a week before classes start?
Of course.
It's always a little dicier, right? And right. So it's kind of like, let's manage everyone's expectations. We're going to do the best we can, because that's our job, is to make things accessible, but it's going to be challenging.
Mm-hmm. And so really that planning process is a continuing process. So even in the best case scenario where a student has come during the summer, it continues throughout the year as their classes change. And even you mentioned, like, well, if you're going to have a test, you need to advocate for yourself of, you know, what you need for that, you know, for that test. And I'm guessing it would be helpful, again, not to do that just a few days before the test if they know,
right,
you know, from their the plan that the professor gives them of, like, when their tests will be throughout the semester.
Right. Yeah, because depending on the type of an exam, right, even when we're having our you know, proactive meetings with our faculty to make a plan, we're communicating to them as well, what's our timeline for those kinds of learning activities. So, you know, an exam in a chemistry class, we may need a week in advance to be able to get that in a workable format that a student can even, can independently work through using their screen reader, or potentially, you know, having someone who might be reading or scribing in some cases where there's, you know, more notation, or that's the need of the student. So we're often telling faculty we need the exam a week in advance, right, as well. So for our students, it's sometimes, yes, our instructions to most students are 3 business days in advance to schedule your exam, but we're going to need to know the test dates a lot earlier so we can kind of and have the materials so we can ensure that you're going to have access when the exam comes.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of the other side of things. I've been thinking more of from the student's perspective and advocating and planning. But do you also see challenges as you're working with faculty and being able, if they're not used to having to, you know, have things, obviously they plan, but more in advance than they would normally have things available.
Yes. It's been interesting with this proactive model. We're very fortunate. We have wonderful faculty at MSU Denver who really do appreciate the importance of accessibility. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there's different levels of accessibility, and many of our faculty members have learned how to make courses accessible to a level that meets most students' needs. And, you know, mm-hmm. So a student with a learning disability who's, say, using text-to-speech to read books An accessible PDF is going to work with that software,
right.
But an accessible PDF is not going to play nice with the screen reader. And so I think a lot of them, when we first are sitting down, are like, well, my course is accessible. I've gone through some trainings. I've done these things. And then as you start to break it down a little deeper of kind of, okay, yes, but with a student using JAWS, they're going to need a Word doc or text-based file. And so, yes, you have materials that would typically meet most students' needs, but now we have to layer another level of access on this, right? We need to think about it in different ways. You know, a lot of our students with learning disabilities, a picture paints 1,000 words and seeing something, right? And so some of them will say, oh, I struggle with reading, but when I see an image of content, it helps me to make sense of it. Well, for our students who are blind, that image now needs to have a context as well. It needs to have access. And so that's a whole other level of thinking. You know, we've talked to our faculty after they've had a student in their class who's blind. And I think they learn a lot. I think they learn a lot in terms of their teaching. You know, many of them don't realize how many times they'll say, as you see here, or this or that, without any sort of really descriptive language, and even that's an accommodation on the letters, is to remind folks to use verbal descriptions when they're teaching. So I think a lot of them, they learn a lot during that experience. I think it's a lot more work to make the content accessible, and the relationships in which the faculty are really like totally buy in, get the timelines are a little bit more organized and structured and have materials well in advance, it always goes smoother. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we have faculty who are also trying to, you know, will say, well, I like to make choices and be a little bit more on the fly. And we kind of, that's wonderful, but.
Right. I can see with certain subjects and certain topics having things that are coming out of, you know, current events and things that are happening, you know, as the semester is going on, can be important and very relevant. And so there'd be turnaround times that were quicker for those types of materials. So,
right.
Melissa, do you have any other tips or practical advice for students or their parents as they're preparing for this transition and students preparing to advocate for themselves, where, you know, perhaps their parents have been more of a support as they've been younger, obviously, and going through school, but now taking on more of that role themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think a key piece of self-advocacy is really knowing yourself, right? Knowing what your strengths are, knowing what has worked for you, and being able to articulate that. Being able to articulate where are the places where you do see these barriers come up, and when you might need accommodations, what accommodations are useful. I think it's really good for students in high school who are thinking about college to be practicing those advocacy skills. So getting used to maybe sending an email or reaching out to teachers to talk about what their needs are. Taking a more active role in those IEP or 504 plan meetings when people are talking about accommodations and talking about how you are as a learner, they shouldn't be talking about you. You should be involved in that conversation and leading some of that discussion. I think, you know, exploring your options early in terms of college. So it's never too early to start to take advantage of some opportunities. You know, MSU Denver does an open house in October and one in March. They've moved those dates up earlier in the processes for students to kind of take advantage. And even if you don't think you're going to MSU Denver, if you're local, it might be a good starting point to see what colleges have to offer. I love the open house because all of the student resources there are there. All of the, you know, academic departments are there. There's a tour. There's a lot of information about what does it look like to go through the financial aid process. We have a session on accommodations and something like that, those transition fairs, those open houses that are close to you, info days, whatever, are great opportunities just to start to think about what college looks like and formulate your questions as you start to figure out what the place is that you want to be at. We do informational sessions, so reach out to the Disability Service Office as part of your college searches and have conversations about what the timeline is, because a lot of places would definitely appreciate to hear from a student who uses a screen reader and who's thinking about coming, like, hey, I'm really looking and are heavily considering this institution. And so what would that process look like? What would be your ideal timeline so that everything can move as smoothly as possible? I really appreciate it when I see, you know, I said the summer, but when I hear a student even months in advance say, hey, you know, my goal is to be starting at MSU Denver at this point in time. So, okay, let's work out what is the timeline then for our relationship.
Right. So really, you know, when you see students starting to look at where they want to attend college junior year, you know, well before even their senior year, maybe even earlier, mm-hmm. that is an appropriate time to also be looking into accessibility, or being able to attend something like an open house would be open to students that are just considering, that maybe haven't been accepted or they haven't made application yet, but they're trying to make their selection.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. I think it helps students to, you know, I used to drag my kids when I'd have to work open house and they were in their sophomore year. I'd say, well, find some friends. I'm happy for everyone else to come on a Saturday morning with me while I'm working and have you explore, because I think that's a great opportunity for students just to, you can't even imagine all the majors. And, you know, it's a good place to ask about, you know, what does a major entail? Because sometimes students are really interested in something and but they're not really kind of science folks, and they don't realize how much science is the background of that major. So, you know, really exploring your options, looking at your resources, it informs all of then your discussions as you go through that college search, then to be able to say, okay, this school had a writing center and it was free services. Now I'm visiting this other institution. Tell me a little bit about your support when it comes to writing. Mm-hmm. Is that free? Is it easy to meet with a writing center tutor? Those are important conversations. And so I think, you know, even if a student finds themselves on a campus where they're like, I don't want to go here at all, this isn't the place for me, there's something to be learned about that, right? There's something that, okay, what is it about this place that doesn't feel like home? Because as a mother of a child who just went through a college search and will be starting someplace in the fall, we went to a lot of places. And then when he hit the place that was his place, mm-hmm. you could tell he was just really excited, right? Yeah. And so that was good to see. It felt exhausting as a parent going to everything, but it feels good when it all clicks and the pieces start to come together, and it's like, okay, these are the reasons why I like this particular place, and I think it's going to be my home for the next 4 years or five or six, whatever.
Yeah, whatever it may be. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Melissa, thank you so much for sharing this information with our listeners. I'm sure they will find it helpful. And then you're going to be joining us again next week, and we're going to dive a little bit deeper into specific strategies and resources for students with vision loss, specifically, since you've been working with them. So we look forward to talking with you again. Just a reminder to everybody listening to subscribe and tune in next time, and check out some of our other podcasts that you may enjoy as well. The Blind Chick or Blind Level Tech, or our newest podcast is Game Changers, and talking about accessible sports. So look into that and see, there might be some other podcasts that you find of interest. You can always contact us or learn more information through our website, which is aftersight.org. And we hope that all of this information is helping you navigate your life with vision loss.